Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Our efforts to save journalism likely to kill it just the same. As for-profit media companies scale back expenses in an effort to survive declines in advertising revenues, some are turning to inexpensive outsourced content providers to fill the gaps left by departing journalists. Companies set up to aggregate and distribute such content are currently earning sustainable profits, and their influence is expanding. But as veteran journalist and author Thomas Frank explains, the automation required to run these content mills serves to deprofessionalize journalism just when we need it most. Frank writes The Easy Chair for Harper's Magazine. His essay in the December 2010 issue is called Bright Frenetic Mills. Tom, welcome to Think.
How are you today, Chris?
I'm doing well, thank you. What is a content mill?
That's sort of a pejorative term that people use to describe these businesses that, you know, generate copy, I guess you would say, generate stories that that are all over the place online and are increasingly, you see them now and again in actual newspapers. I guess the diagnostic feature is they have this enormous army of freelancers, and you know, that they hook up with via the internet, and they pay them very little for, you know, a short piece of writing, and they assign the writing, they assign what stories to write using sort of, well, I guess we would say innovative methods.
Essentially, they figure out what people are most often searching for on Google.
Exactly. Or that's how one of the companies that I wrote about, that's how they do it. This is a company called Demand Media, and they've developed a computer program that they call it an algorithm that looks at what people are searching for on Google and assigns, you know, and figures out what to assign journalists to write about. Using that, and they sort of match that up with what they think advertisers are most likely to pay for. I tell you, it's a bright future for journalism.
What they're saying, Demand Media and these other companies, is that this is basically just about giving the people what they want.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and you could say that about... the funny thing about when I first encountered that line, you know, doing my research for this essay, I hadn't written about journalism for a long time, and last time I did, I was writing about the Gannett chain of newspapers. You know, these are the guys that own USA Today, mm-hmm. and they used to say that very same thing back in the 1990s. And if you look at sort of what, there's also a lot of foundation money these days going into journalism with, you know, various efforts to try to prop it up or rescue it and that sort of thing. And they say the same thing, that what you really have to do to make journalism survive is, you know, give the reader what they want, you know, listen to the audience. And the funny thing is that journalists themselves are only, you know, they're only too happy to do that. You know, if you read about, you know, the way newsroom cultures work, there's a lot of rivalry to have the, you know, most emailed story or most read, most viewed, that sort of thing.
So I did a quick search for Associated Content, which is one of the big players in this landscape, and I have to tell you I was astounded. First place took me to a page that promised I could find, this is a quote, find my audience and earn money by sharing my unique perspective with audiences worldwide. Then just like that, there's a Get Started button that takes me to a page to sign up. Now, it doesn't know that I am a journalist. I could be anybody.
Well, of course. That's the idea.
Well, I know, but it really is. I mean, for people who haven't been familiar with this, it's sort of scary.
Well, yeah, we're all going to be journalists. And look, in some ways, that's a really wonderful thing. I mean, look, there's aspects of the sort of... you know, the blog revolution and all that are really, really great. When you've got everybody writing about things, there's all sorts of upside to that. But there's also, you know, all kinds of downside. There's reasons, you know, there's occasions where you really want a professional doing this work. You know, I hate to stand up for professionalism. Professionalism just rubs me the wrong way, but there it is.
Well, what do you make of the pushback that people will say, well, journalists like to convince themselves that they're the only ones who can do this work? Can you speak to that argument?
That they're the only ones that can do this work, and that, well, look, that's an argument that I used to make myself. I started out, I didn't, you know, start out in conventional journalism. I didn't go to journalism school. I went to, you know, they didn't have a journalism department where I went to college. I went to, and I went to graduate school, and I was doing history. And do you want to hear the whole story? It's kind of funny.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I was, this is how the Harper story sort of opens with this anecdote. I was teaching in Chicago at a college on the north side, and I was earning just some incredibly small amount of money. And this is after, I had gone through all these years and got this PhD and, had all this various success that one has in graduate school and all that sort of thing. And I was earning, I think, $1,500 for an entire semester of work. And that was just the way the job market was at that point. I understand it's even worse today. But you got paid very, very little for doing a whole lot of work. And I looked around me, and I was at the same time writing a story for the Chicago Reader, the alternative news weekly. It was one of the great ones in its heyday, and I got paid basically more for doing that, for writing that story. That was a story that I did for that entire semester of work, teaching as a lecturer at this college. And so I said, the hell with that. I went into journalism because I thought that was a practical career move.
That's where the big money lay.
Yeah, I know. And it seems like a joke in retrospect that it was true. But I never, up until a few years ago when I started writing for the Wall Street Journal, I was not part of the journalistic mainstream. I was always outside of it. And so when you say, other people say, well, journalists do such a lousy job, I could do it better. That was exactly my attitude, That was exactly why I did it, because I thought they missed the ball so many times, And by the way, there's plenty of evidence for that argument. I mean, you look at the two biggest, let's say the three biggest journalism failures of the last 10 years. First of all, the whole Iraq war thing, the weapons of mass destruction that turned out to not be there, and and it all turns out after the fact that the media has been essentially, echoing what the administration wanted them to echo. And then, second of all, they're just complete failure to see the financial crisis coming, the disasters of 2008, to see that coming. Although there were people in the media here and there, including some of my friends, that did see it, and could not shut up about it. They're talking all the time about it, but the mainstream media brushed all that off. Would not publish it, and their attitude towards companies and CEOs. I'm talking about business reporting in particular here. Was so what's the word for it? It was so grotesque. It was so deferential. That they weren't able to do the sort of to take the and both of these were failures of inability to have a critical attitude by the press. And I think a lot of people, that they find that really that journalism is just failing at to do what it promised, its most basic function. The other great disaster is the demise of the newspapers, and these people didn't even see that coming. And it's their own industry.
Well, I don't want to get too far off track here, but I have to follow up to this, because what do you think it is? What distinguishes those stories, that reporting that does find its way into the echo chamber and then become something that everyone sort of takes to be true, from those things? As you mentioned, there were people here and there that predicted, let's just stick with the financial crisis. But that wasn't, is it nobody wanted to hear that?
That's a good question. I think the people who were talking about it were outside the mainstream. Can I tell you another funny anecdote? This is sort of, I'm sorry, I always go off on these anecdotes.
We've got an hour. Go ahead. It's
okay. So like I said, I lived in Chicago for many years, and I before that, by the way, I came from Kansas, which is right north of you, and so I was living in Chicago, moved to Washington D.C. And I had a best-selling book at the time, and the Washington Post did a profile of me, which is very flattering. But the profile had this hilarious quote from somebody, and I'm going to butcher it. I'm not going to get it exactly right, but they basically said that you didn't need to listen to me because I was outside the consensus. And it's a very Washington attitude. I thought at the time that's a very Washington attitude. And what I've since discovered is that attitude really. That's the attitude of the mainstream media you know, that they were, this is part of the downside of professionalism. You know, they're, part of their understanding themselves as professionals is that they only listen to people that are inside the consensus, you know, to other professionals. And so I had economist friends who were talking all the time about, you know, the real estate bubble, but they were outside the consensus. You know, they were outside the mainstream. The mainstream was people like Alan Greenspan, you know, who has now found a flaw in his theory, which is, you know, a little too late for that. But and that's a huge part of the problem, is that they don't, they're not able to look outside the consensus.
Yeah, what's also so vexing about that is that now, as we're trying to figure out where we are, I think it's disquieting for a lot of people that there is no consensus about whether we're going to turn the recession around. I mean, we have numbers that the recession is over, but no one can quite agree on whether there's a bright future or a really dim future. And so it makes it hard to sort of understand where we are.
Oh, I know. I talk to economists all day, every day, and it's very frustrating because you get such differing opinions. And look, maybe I'm being too harsh in my criticism. One of the huge problems that these people have is, you know, you say that there's a real estate bubble, but you can never really tell that something is a bubble until, or this is what they say in their defense.
Yeah.
You can't really tell that something is a bubble until after it's burst. But I don't know. I thought that one was really obvious, and I thought the dot-com bubble back in the late 1990s was also really obvious. And I don't know what the, you know, where we're heading right now economically, but you know, even though we are technically out of a recession, the numbers are still very bleak, you know, unemployment and all that. But we're getting kind of far afield there.
Is there, let's go back to the issue of these content mills. Is there a market at all for serious journalists to, in fact, break stories through these channels? Is it possible?
I'm sure it is possible, but that's, you know, they're not really after news stories
yeah.
yet.
Yeah.
These content mills are in an early stage of development, and they mainly write what they mainly are looking for, what they mainly commission, tend to be sort of lifestyle stories or you know, features, that sort of thing. They don't do straight news yet. But the reason I focused on them is because they're a particularly vivid example of it's the future. You know, they're a glaring neon sign telling us what direction we're heading in, and that direction is towards the destruction of the news media. Years ago, when I used to write about this stuff, everybody thought it was really sad when a two newspaper town became a one newspaper town.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're in a situation where cities are losing newspapers altogether. In some cases the newspaper saves itself by going online, but they still have, you know, cut their newsroom staff in half or by two-thirds or something like that. It's a profession that so far is not sustainable, or it appears to be not sustainable by the sort of traditional for-profit model.
Journalist and author Thomas Frank is my guest. He writes the Easy Chair column for Harper's Magazine. This month, his essay is called Bright Frenetic Mills. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Thomas Frank. He writes the Easy Chair column for Harper's Magazine. His essay this month about so-called content mills is called Bright Frenetic Mills. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tom, how is this content edited and fact-checked before it's put out in the world?
They have the procedures. They have freelance copy editors as well, who are also paid very little. And fact checking, that's one I'm sorry, I don't know about. I don't recall what I found in my research on that front. But they do have copy editors.
Is there any sort of accountability for the individual? Well, let's call them writer, if not journalist. If something happens to be wrong, do you know that?
This is a common criticism of them, that they get things wrong all the time. And I would say that there probably is very little accountability, and that's the direction that we're going in, you know, as a whole, as an industry. What's really ironic about all this, I mean, the sort of grand overarching irony, is that we expect, you know, in the case of the content mills and in all sorts of other aspects of life nowadays, we expect accountability to be delivered by the internet, you know, by everybody interacting and everybody calling out what's wrong, and, you know, and people, you know, if they see something wrong, jumping on it. And it's sort of an equivalent to, weirdly enough, to the idea that just failed in the financial crisis, you know, the idea that there is no fraud in a free market, you know, in a market economy, because of course everybody would figure it out and they wouldn't deal with the fraudster. But as we now know, the market was filled with all kinds of fraudulent operations, and yet that's the sort of, I'm sorry, this I don't know why you'd be interested in this, but this is the kind of doctrine that we're counting on to save us from bad information, this sort of competition of all against all. But what I see happening, I always focus on the ways in which, you know, market failure is possible. And the thing that just strikes me is so obvious, you know, especially after, you know, I was telling about the journalistic failures of the last 10 years, where basically the problem is always the same thing, that journalists are beholden to power. The journalists don't criticize power. Well, what happens when you completely deprofessionalize that job and you pay journalists as you drive their wages down as low as the market will bear, you know, until you start sending people away? What happens then? Do you think they're going to be willing to stand up to power then? You know, the answer is obviously, you know, of course not.
Well, and the other thing that concerns me about this model, and if you think just about lifestyle content, an argument could be made that a lot of it is not that important if an error is made. If you get instructions for roasting a turkey or for making your shampoo last longer or something, but you also have no way of knowing what ties the individual writer might have to any organization whatsoever.
That's right. It's there's all kinds of ways in which corruption could enter into this process undetected. There's all sorts of ways.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Thomas Frank is my guest. We're talking about his essay in the December issue of Harper's Magazine, Bright Frenetic Mills. Let's go on the phones now and speak with Robbie in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Oh, hi. Thank you. You know, I read somewhere that about the 100 institutions that have survived over 500 years, about 80 of them are universities. And most of them have survived because of endowments. And I was wondering, I wanted to ask a guest, why don't the newspapers follow this model? They've been around for many, many years, and they're always scrambling for, you know, profits and all the cycles. Why don't they set themselves up as university endowments?
You know, that's a really good idea. There are some places where university journalism departments are basically trying to become something very close to a newspaper. And there's also a lot of nonprofit work to try to rescue newspapers. But so far, the American nonprofit sector hasn't been very effective at this. There are a couple, you know, success stories. There's one called ProPublica that does very good economic reporting, business reporting. But there's, you know, the sort of sad counterexample, there's a newspaper or an online publication here in Washington called the Washington Independent that was very good, that just closed down. Foundations so far have not showed themselves to be, you know, willing to support or sustain this kind of operation over a really long period. And I guess, you know, the problem with an endowment is first you got to get that endowment. The old model, you know, of a family owning a newspaper and hanging on to it through thick and thin and sort of running it as a community trust, I think that model could conceivably work. The problem is you've got so few of those operations left. You know, over the last 20 or 30 years, basically everybody wanted to cash in. You know, they didn't want to hold on to the family newspaper anymore. They wanted to sell it when newspaper stocks were at the sort of, you know, historical high, which was in the 1990s. And although it was possible, even in the 1990s, to see, you know, to see the internet coming and to see that all this stuff was coming, almost nobody took any steps to, you know, to prepare for this day that's now, this, you know, disastrous day that's now arrived.
How culpable are news consumers for refusing to pay for the content they consume?
Well, you know, I can't really blame them. That's how we do things here in America. We sort of expect media or culture to be free, right? You turn on the TV and the radio, and there it is. And you know, newspapers have always been, you know, from free to just pennies. You know, they cost very, very little, and so that's just how we're accustomed to doing it. There's also, you know, there's a good argument to be made for that. People should be well informed, even if they can't afford it. You know, even if they can't afford to pay for things. You know, that every citizen should have access to the news. This is just a ray of sunshine.
We have an email here from Paul in Terrell who writes, Mark Twain once said, never pick a fight with a man who buys his ink by the barrel. He was talking about rich newspaper publishers. Now newspapers are fading in influence, but what about heavily subsidized bloggers? Some of the most influential on various political sites are well supported by advertisers.
Is that so? I don't know a lot. I mean, I don't know about the economics of blogging. I mean, I know that some people are able to make a living at it. There have been a number of stories broken by blogs, but they're nowhere close to doing the kind of coverage that newspapers used to do. I mean, when a blog does break a story, it's a news event in itself, and we hear a lot about it, and it's a big deal. But you think about the way your local paper used to cover City Hall, used to cover the police force, used to cover, you know, everything that went on in the community. There's no blogging model yet that I've seen. There's no for-profit model that would allow someone to do that. It just doesn't exist. There's a guy that I talk to a lot about this subject named Bob McChesney. He wrote a very good book on the subject of what's happening to newspapers. It came out last year, and you know, he goes through all the different models, you know, for what could replace the newspaper, and discovers that basically all of them are not sound. None of them have delivered, you know, anything like what the newspaper used to deliver. And that's you know, admitting all the flaws of journalism, all the flaws that we discussed earlier in this conversation.
Did we set ourselves up to fail by initially making newspapers a for-profit business?
That's a really good question. And what McChesney, this guy, the guy that I just referred to, and he's a professor at the University of Illinois, what he comes back to is that that's what we have to get around, that idea that newspapers have to be for-profit ventures. And once we do that, then maybe we can start figuring out where the future lies. And he also points out, and this is something that I did not know until I read his book, that newspapers were at one point heavily subsidized in America, indirectly, of course, and it was through the post office that it was that newspapers were allowed to send stuff out very cheaply. This is in the 19th century. They got enormous subsidies. So, you know, because basically the founding fathers wanted a lively press.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Pat in Dallas. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for the program again. I belong to an online group called RSN, Reader Supported News, And what they do is they gather liberal-leaning editorials and articles from the media, and then they send them out to you. You pay for that. And I'm wondering who gets the money then when you've paid Mark Ash at Reader-Supported News.
Golly, I don't know. I've never heard of that one before, but it sounds like you know, a form of syndication. And it would the amount that you get is very small. I'm speaking as an author here. It's very small, but yeah, it would generally go back to the author and the publication that originally published the work.
By the way, are newspapers or websites or people that are using content mill content, are they paying for that content? Are they actually compensated if it brings in ad dollars? How does that work?
I imagine so. I don't know the specifics on that, but I'm sure they are. You know, it's not the whole idea is to have a for-profit system here.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, "So would the people running demand media say that the people weren't getting what they wanted during the heyday of serious magazines like The New Yorker, Life, Newsweek, The Atlantic? Were the people mistaken about their wants until the internet arrived?"
Well, that's a really good question. Now, there is a whole school of thinking out there in the sort of higher reach. This is the second half of my Harper's article. There's a whole school of thought in the upper reaches of journalism land, at journalism schools around the country, where they contemplate, you know, what is the future for journalism. There's a lot of models that look like demand media and a lot of, you know, internet-based things, and they all start with this, you know, critique of the press that the media failed so dramatically, you know, that it's always been a huge, terrible failure, and the reason it's been such a failure is because it doesn't listen to what the public wants, and it's this elitist enterprise, and so all of these things take on this sort of populist tone, you know, we're giving the people what they want, and as I said, you know, I'm highly critical of the press myself. You heard what I said earlier in the interview. I've always thought that they fail in all sorts of ways. But I mean, he wrote an email to you. Is that what the guy did? He's totally right there. You know, mm-hmm. It's you're talking about the sort of the great classics of journalism. You know, when I decided to write this article, I didn't do it because an algorithm told me to. You know, I did it because I'm worried about what's happening to our country.
You write about your concern that this new model gets written off as gets written off as a sort of short-sighted resistance to emerging technology.
That's right. In fact, if you go online, that's the by and large the response to my article.
Why is that such an easy sell, that argument?
It's for one thing, it's simple. For another thing, that's an argument that you'll find online. And obviously that's where if you're talking about the technology via the technology, it's sort of, you know, self-reinforcing. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the sort of storylines that people have adopted just in the last 15 years, the sort of notion that the internet is going to save us all. You know, it's comforting, it's tidy, and it has a happy ending. And it's also very easy to dismiss people that you disagree with as just being, tech-blind curmudgeons and not really understanding. Although that, you know, clearly isn't the case here. I do my research. I use the internet constantly. In fact, I'm sort of addicted to it. It's kind of a problem. You know, I never get my work done anymore. But, you know, I do all of my research that way. I correspond with people that way. I mean, I'm here in Washington and my editors are in New York and we send the article back and forth that way.
And lest anybody be confused about this, you're not arguing that serious news must be delivered on dead trees. You think there's a lot of delivery platforms that work.
That's kind of a red herring, and yet that's really where, if you read a lot of the sort of big thinkers of the journalism world, that's what they'll tell you the argument is about. And I don't really care one way or the other. Although about the delivery mechanism, but I will say this for paper. Harper's Magazine, we do long form essays, and we do fiction, we do quality journalism, quality prose. And what I find is that it's much easier and it's more pleasurable to read something like that on on paper than it is on the computer screen. And I don't know, that might just be me.
Mm-hmm.
But I've found that when I, you know, if I write something on the, you know, on my computer, and then I print it out, you know, I read it on the screen and I edit it and I do my best with it, and then I print it out on paper, it suddenly reads very differently.
Huh.
On paper. Suddenly all my standards for viewing it change. So but as for the news itself, no, I mean, you know, of course, it has nothing to do with the mode that it's delivered in.
I have to say, I really like things that are printed on paper, and I do a lot of reading electronically as well. I have no bias there, but I like being able to scribble all over a magazine article as I'm reading.
Yes. And I'm sorry to say, I do that to books as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Michael in Fort Worth. Hey, Michael.
Hey, I just kind of had a comment. It seems like newspapers are just old technology now. You know, we can't buy an 8-track tape or a cassette tape anymore. And, you know, people still listen to records, but you got to go to a boutique to buy one. You can't just pick them up anywhere anymore. I mean, is that seems kind of like where maybe the future of that's going at this point.
Yeah, that's partially true. And also, you know, remember what made the newspaper profitable, what allowed it to be profitable, you know, back in the 90s and the 80s and, you know, going back, was that it, you know, it basically they had a kind of a monopoly on news gathering in every city and also on advertising. And that allowed the kind of profits that supported journalism. So it was sort of an unusual, you know, coming together of circumstances that allowed it to work, that allowed the news media to work in the first place. And I guess to get to the bottom of this question about, you know, for-profit newspapers, the thing is that, you know, obviously we want, that's the ideal system, is to have a newspaper that can survive all on its own and doesn't need any help from anybody and is fiercely independent and all those wonderful things. But the news is too important to, you know, you can't just let this industry die. We can, and we are just letting it die. But it's too important for the health of the country to just let it disappear.
Thomas Frank is my guest. His Easy Chair essay in the December issue of Harper's Magazine is titled Bright Frenetic Mills. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Thomas Frank. His essay in the December issue of Harper's Magazine is called Bright Frenetic Mills. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, Tom, what I think is so frustrating about this examination of what's going wrong and many others that we've discussed on the show and probably read and heard of elsewhere is that we can all point to what's not working and why, but no one yet has come up with anything that will replace what we've lost.
Yeah, that's right. And I should say the one, you know, I had a lot of hope for the foundation model,
mm-hmm.
but it hasn't exactly worked out. You know, the way that we thought it would, and so far there's no indication that the foundation model will be able to do anything more than, you know, have a website here and there. There are you know, some newspapers that are going to make the transition. Up until recently, I worked for the Wall Street Journal, and that's what, you know, the one newspaper in America that seems to be making the transition to the internet without a whole lot of problems. In Europe, a lot of newspapers have been able to do it, and I'm not exactly certain why it's been different there, except for that they probably planned for it, you know, more in advance. As I said, my friend Bob McChesney, who I turn to on a lot of these questions, he suggests a model of where there's government subsidies for the press, where the press is subsidized in some way, and there's ways that you can build the model so that it leaves out the possibility of of bias one way or the other. But I don't think that that's, you know, that's not the direction that the country is heading in right now. You know, if anything, we're, you know, the people are angry about government intervention in the economy. You know, they're not ready to sign up for something like that. So I don't think that's, you know, although that's a really good idea, I don't think it's on the table at the moment. And so the, you know, once you rule out all those things, I'm very sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
Well, and as one who earns her living in public broadcasting, people are not crazy about the amount of government subsidies that go into our model here.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that we have an amazing newsroom here, but quite frankly, it's much smaller than any for-profit newsroom in this region.
Yeah.
There's just not enough money to duplicate it. Are people do readers understand the difference between journalist-generated content and this other stuff?
Not if you put it in a daily newspaper. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, there's all kinds of experiments like that going on, and by and large, they aren't noticed. I mean, the newspaper that's done this most prominently is USA Today, and mm-hmm. I guess they got some criticism in the internet and stuff like that, but nothing that I saw a lot of. You know, the Washington Post these days, you know, to go to the sort of world of prestige journalism. The Washington Post is experimenting with running content produced by various sort of foundation operations, and so far it has not looked very good. I mean, the articles often have this sort of very obvious political slant to them, and readers get really angry. You know, they think they're being tricked. It's so far it doesn't look good.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Haroon in Dallas. Hi, Haroon.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great,
I
thanks.
Just had actually two comments that I would want our guests to expand on. The first would be, it was mentioned by Robbie, newspapers, if they take the model that universities have applied earlier as to where they're based on funding and are being supported by various, you know, organizations, if you will, don't you think that would induce some sort of political bias or agenda towards a certain degree or induce a certain degree of slant towards a certain agenda? And the second comment would be, again, with the Internet revolution of how newspapers are coming up with different ideas and different ways to put their content online, don't you think that's actually a good way to weed out the bad press and just stick to certain few newspapers that people are actually well acquainted with, and perhaps that would help journalism in general?
I think it's always better when there's more visibility and more competition among ideas, but you know, this is a big country. There's 300 million people in America, you know, so many cities, so many local governments, and you know, I live here in Washington D.C. where the place is crawling with reporters. You know, and there everything gets covered, or a lot, I should say, most things get covered. I've actually found there's lots of places where that they miss, lots of spots that they miss. But every newspaper in America used to have a Washington bureau, and so this is the one place in America, the one landscape that's heavily scrutinized. You know, but you go to a city like Baltimore, like, you know, I'm from Kansas City. You go to a place like that, and there the scrutiny has just sort of receded. It's just sort of disappeared. It would, you know, it would be great if those cities all had, you know, three competing newspapers going at it with one another to offer the best coverage of City Hall or the fire department or what, you know, whatever it is, you know, the local real estate developers or something like that. It would be fantastic. But we're heading in the other direction. I'm always reminded. Do you remember that the famous play in the movie The Front Page?
I don't.
Oh, come on. Yes, you do. They made a version of it. What was it? His Gal Friday. Remember, they made a version of it in the 40s with Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, it's a famous movie. It's set in Chicago in the 1920s. And at the time, in the movie, the city has seven daily newspapers, you know.
And they're in this, oh, my goodness.
They're in this sort of crazy competition with one another. And that's the, you know, that's the golden age. That's, I mean, although the caller also asked about bias. I mean, that was before there were any sort of professional standards, you know, for journalism was crazy biased back then.
Maybe the thing that's not sustainable is objective journalism.
It's possible. I mean, it is expensive, and that's objective journalism is the that's the product of professionalism. You know, mm-hmm. that's when professionalism caught on over the course of the 20th century. That's sort of what it delivered, and what it that's what it brought to the table. And you know, if you take away professionalism, I don't see how you can possibly retain that. Now, I had my own beefs with objective journalism. You know, the obvious one, it's impossible to be objective, and it also, it's very easy for political actors to sort of game the system, mm-hmm. you know, and you've heard all these criticisms many times, I'm sure, especially over there at NPR. But by and large, objectivity is that's a great thing. If it really worked, that would be fantastic. I would love it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jay in Fort Worth. Hello, Jay.
Hi. Just a quick question for you. What do you think about, or what are your thoughts on news aggregation websites like FARC and some of the other ones that are out there? You know, I'd say 80% are actual newspaper, and then the other 20% are just random content. But what are your thoughts on that?
My problem was that, I understand that they're giving away the content for free, and this is this you know, the huge thing that the newspapers are fighting against. And what I would like to see is people be able to get the content for free and have the newspapers survive. And I know that the way it is right now, it looks like you can't have both. And I think that's tragic. I think it's the sort of cornucopia of information that you can find on the internet is a wonderful thing. I mean, in some ways, it's this moment of great enlightenment. But if it winds up killing the newspapers because their stories are being distributed for free and all that sort of thing, then that's going to be a terrible disaster. So I would like to see both have my cake and eat it. If that's okay with you.
If you can do that, tell us the secret. And not gain weight either. It seems as if in the past we had, as you mentioned, multiple sources maybe of journalism. These days we spend more time than ever in our history consuming information and interacting with it. Do you sense that the percentage of that time spent consuming hard news and serious information has actually diminished?
I read polls that say it has, and I'm always astonished. I'm a newspaper guy, right? Mm-hmm. I read three newspapers every day. I go on the websites of a couple of others. That's what I read. But whenever you look at how the American public gets their information, it's by and large it's from TV and increasingly from the internet, where they're able to you're able to sort of filter out views that you don't want to hear, and even news that you don't want to hear. I have a very bleak take on all of this stuff, and I'm really sorry.
So you've not heard anything in the past 5 years that convinces you there might be a way out of this?
Well, no. There's various models that might work. I just think that the country is headed in the opposite direction. Uh-huh. I think the public funding idea is a really good one. I think that it would be nice if the foundations got together and figured this out, and came up with some kind of permanent solution. But I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think either one of those is going to happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to George in Fort Worth. Hi, George.
Hi there. Just one comment and also a question. I think the idea of public financing is absolutely horrible. I understand the rationale behind it, but having worked in both print and broadcasting for 30 years through what's gone on, I think that's just a formula for disaster. NPR's funding from the federal government and what goes on with that should be a perfect example of what would happen. But the question that I have is...
Let me stop you for a second. Example meaning because it's controversial?
Well, because it's subject to the whims of how the political winds are blowing. Mm-hmm. If the Republicans are in control, they go after NEA or they go after NPR. And if the Democrats are, depending on who's in charge, it may not be as bad. But sometimes with budget cuts and all the rest of the stuff, NPR gets whacked upside the head.
I will just say this, and I want to let you continue your comment. We don't serve the Democrats or the Republicans. I know you are aware of that.
Oh, I know that. Mm-hmm. But my point simply being that the winds of change batter you, and there's politics involved. And if you do that with newspapers, or which is what we're talking about, I just think that's a formula for disaster, no matter how good the intent is. My question is this. Over the years, the one factor that's not being discussed, or at least I haven't heard, is the issue of consolidation. And one of the things that I think, at least I saw during my career, was the failure of the FCC and others to step in and stop the ability of large corporations to buy and therefore control access. And the result of that has been that when you look at the Star Telegram or some of the other papers, with the exception perhaps of the Dallas paper, because they're the flagship for Belo, what you're seeing is that there's a combination of expenses that local papers don't have to bear. And I realize that local papers sometimes have to eat expenses that they might not want. But local coverage is what makes newspapers work and local television stations, and we've managed to lose it all through the consolidation effort. So I'd like to hear what your
Thanks so much for your call.
That's certainly true. And that's sort of the story of the 1990s. This is something that I used to write about back in the day. As I said earlier, I used to focus on the Gannett chain in particular, and the way that they came up with all kinds of sort of, you know, ingenious ways of you know, owning a whole bunch of small town papers or small city papers and running them, you know, in a way much cheaper than anybody else could do, and thereby, you know, making these sort of, you know, really extravagant profits. And by the way, and you've seen the same thing in radio, you know, that after the deregulation in 1996, the sort of amazing consolidation of the radio industry, and this is an industry that used to be very localized, and instantly, you know, just in within a matter of years, was heavily concentrated, owned by just a few big chains. There's a very strange connection here. I don't know if you were following the news about the Chicago Tribune, which is one of the sort of great American newspapers. I used to live in Chicago. Some of my friends still work at the Chicago Tribune. And it got taken over in this kind of disastrous corporate buyout a couple of years ago. And the new management, you know, they're like, well, how can we turn this paper around? Can you guess what they did? They brought in a bunch of radio executives from Clear Channel. there was a big story about it in the New York Times, a sort of frat house environment that ensued, you know, the all the sort of awful things that went on, and these people just wound up getting fired or stepping down a few weeks ago.
Tom, I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there.
That's a great story. Your listeners should read up on it using the internet.
Thomas Frank's article in the December 2010 issue is called Bright Frenetic Mills. It's in Harper's. Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, the pleasure is all mine.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.